On a hot summer's day in 1992, 63-year-old Bessie Kutnick goes looking for her missing cattle near her home in Cameron, Texas. Witnesses say she seemed disorientated and was seen asking for directions before she disappeared. When family members realized she was missing, a full-scale search of her began, but no trace of her was ever found. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
The one where Amy and Vanessa are sick.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Catherine Mary Stewart.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
On today's episode, we are going to be talking about a still missing person. And we've actually been covering solved cases lately, so this is an unusual break for us.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the ones we started with were unsolved. And then it was just like we went through like this little few episodes in a row that were kind of satisfying because they did come to a bit of a closure. I mean, not that, of course, obviously the outcome's not satisfying, but it is nice to have a name.
Right.
So with Bessie, we really just don't know where she is still.
No. So this is going to be unsatisfying in a lot of ways. And one of the ways that it's going to be unsatisfying is that there is actually not a lot of information about her. And when there isn't a lot of information, like other podcasts like ours would, you know, decide not to cover her story just because the media hasn't covered it extensively. There's not a lot of depth of information to go into. But I always think that these kinds of cases deserve attention and care. And so that's what we're attempting to do today.
Yeah, I think it's nice to, when something isn't out in the media as much, obviously this is something that not as many people are going to hear about. Maybe we should be kind of highlighting those things, like getting a little bit more awareness and like just compassion for these people that might go unnoticed.
Right. And so today, you know, there is, just to set off, like not a lot of information about what happened. And we've dealt with this in the past, and so that has actually allowed us to do some things in past episodes. Like when we had Honolulu Jane Doe, she was an unidentified living person, and so we were able to talk about issues surrounding that. You know, we talked about Bitter Creek Betty, and in her episode, we were able to talk about what happens when, you know, the interstate system and killers kind of intersecting there. So, you know, I think that this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about what stories are covered and why those stories are covered and kind of what assumptions that we make when a person is missing and ways we try to frame their stories. And so that's going to be, you know, part of the episode today.
Right. And I think some of them, like with Honolulu Jane Doe, I think first off, it was surprising because I don't think we often think about like unidentified people as being alive. And she was, but also I don't think we talk about older people very much in the media.
We don't. And so Bessie is an older case. So I haven't told you much about her, but we did have some discussion beforehand that this is an older woman. There's not a lot of information. And so really, like, her story could just be easily swept aside and kind of forgotten. And so I'm glad we get to highlight her story, even though there isn't a ton about her.
Me too.
So Bessie Kutnick was 63 when she went missing from her farm in 1992. She lived just outside of Cameron, Texas. So for this story, we're in a rural part of central Texas. The closest larger city is Austin, which is about 70 miles away to help orientate you in the gigantic state of Texas. Bessie was reportedly last seen on foot looking for some of her cattle that had strayed. And that really sums up her story.
So that's it.
She really
was out looking for some of her cattle and then never went home.
Right. And so this is why her story would not necessarily be covered in a lot of media or podcasts or anything like that, because that's the extent of her story. But I do want to actually dig into her background a little bit more because I want to provide some context before I get into my rest of my points about missingness and care and how we tell these stories.
Okay.
So around the turn of the 20th century, Bessie's parents immigrated from a region of Europe known as Moravia. Moravia has been part of various empires and countries throughout history. And at the time they immigrated, it would have been part of Austria-Hungary. But around 1918, it was part of Czechoslovakia. So you'll see in her family records as being listed as Moravian or sometimes as Czechoslovakian. I'm going to note here that it's not that her parents immigrated in some sort of solo fashion. They really settled in this part of Texas with their family members. So both families were well represented in this area. And there does seem to be a population of Czechoslovakian immigrants in this area. And I'm prefacing this because there's a good reason soon. But Bessie's parents were married in Milam County, Texas in April of 1912. Though there's a bunch of discrepancies in birth years for this family, meaning there's clear differences in information from various records, the one thing I can say is that they started having children a few years later. It looks like Annie was the oldest, followed by Lydia or Liddy, Mary, Frank, and Joe. Finally, Bessie was born on May 1st, 1929. The Kutnick family mostly worked as farmers and seemed very tied to their land in Cameron, Texas. Bessie's brother Frank, though, was drafted in World War II. Unfortunately, he was one of 504 U.S. soldiers who lost their lives when his ship sank in the Mediterranean Sea in 1944.
So this is not their family's first, like, meeting with grief.
No. So even though I love generally spending time in records, I could spend all day looking up various census records and birth records. I don't typically share a lot of family histories. It's not something we regularly cover as part of our episodes, but I promise there's a reason that I'm about to like dig into their family history here. Bessie's father was the next to pass away. He died in 1953 at the age of 71 after a brief hospital stay. His cause of death was listed as carcinoma of the esophagus, so basically esophageal cancer. And then Bessie's mom passes away at the age of 63 from acute coronary thrombosis, or in basic terms, a blood clot in the heart. And she passed away at the family home.
So she passed away at the same age that Bessie disappears.
Yeah. Which is going to be part of the point that I'm developing here. So we have both parents passing away in what is considered old age, but not necessarily advanced old age. Now, one thing that is unique about Bessie's sibling set is that none of them get married or have children.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Not any of them.
None of them.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. So when Bessie goes missing in 1992, the news coverage there is of her classifies her as a loner. And I don't like this understanding of her, but really between her parents' death and her disappearance, the Kutnick siblings pass away one by one. And that does leave Bessie living on the family farm alone.
So at this point, she in 1992, when she went missing, she was the last one.
Yes.
Okay.
So to sort of go back in time, the first sibling to pass away after her brother Frank. So the next one was Joe, who passes away. He was only 2 years older than Bessie, and he passed away in 1976. Joe had been working as a city employee as a truck driver and died at the age of 49 from what was listed as cerebrovascular accident due to an unknown central nervous system disorder.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds like really complicated, but essentially he died from a stroke.
Oh.
And it was likely due to, like, a longer underlying condition.
Okay. I would never have gotten stroke out of that.
No, I...
What?
Was yeah. Like, what is that? So, you know, okay. Thankfully my medical Googling skills came to the rescue there. Mary is the next sibling who died, and she passed away in 1978 at the Temple Hospital. Her obituary places her age at 61, but her Social Security record documents her as being 59. After that is Lydia, who died in Cameron, Texas at the hospital. Her obituary said she was 62, but her Social Security record places her at 70.
Really? So who would have been doing the obituaries? It would have been a family member.
Yeah.
Who would have done the obituaries and gotten their ages wrong?
It is fascinating.
Social Security mm-hmm. on two of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not used to actually seeing, like, such large discrepancies.
Well, like, 61 to 59, like, I could kind of, like, maybe, you know, but 62 to 70?
Yeah, and then, like, the birth dates are different. I don't even know what was going on.
What is happening here? Okay.
Yeah. But Annie is the last sibling who passes away in 1989 at the age of 74. And so that leaves Bessie living alone from 1989 to 1992. Now, her farm was about 3 miles out from Cameron, so not all that far away, and it seemed like they owned quite a bit of acreage. There's a record from 1981 showing that she leased 81 acres of the land to Hold Oil and Gas Company. Which means, like, we are talking about farming here, but not large-scale farming. It seemed like she made most of her living doing odd jobs around town, so she seemed like, you know, doing some pretty physically strenuous tasks. And Cameron isn't a large town. Its population is around 5,000. So she was actually a pretty recognizable figure around town.
So everybody knows who she is, basically?
Yeah.
And she sounds like a tough lady.
She is a tough lady. She reminds me a lot of, like, my grandmother, like, super independent. My grandmother lived on her own, right? And, like, also did farming and stuff like that. Okay. So, yeah. So she's tough.
Yeah.
So the day she goes missing, it seems that she was out looking for cattle at around 9:30 in the morning. There were reports of her last being seen near Farm Road 486 and County Road 203, a near State Highway 36 West and Farm Road 2269. All of those locations are a significant distance away from her home on Farm Road 2269. So she is seen quite a distance away. In more current reports of this, it is said that she was last seen around Saturday evening walking on a county road, and she was asking for directions and seemed disorientated.
Okay.
And that Saturday would have been August 15th, and the temperatures were pretty hot most of the day. So the highs were in the upper 80s all day. So if she had been looking around for a significant amount of time in the heat, it's not implausible that she could have been experiencing disorientation due to the heat.
And is that what we think?
Well, that's my assumption. You have a hot day. You have, like, a very physically strenuous task. And it seemed like she had been out there for quite a while.
Okay.
On Monday, it sounds like some relatives arrived at her place because they hadn't heard from her. And they found her truck parked at the home with a flat tire, but she was nowhere to be found. What followed was a pretty massive search of the area by law enforcement, neighbors, family, and friends. The terrain there seems to be relatively flat, but with a lot of tall grasses, scrub, and some tree coverage. There are some waterways and bodies of water between the areas she was seen, and the ground cover and this mixed terrain would have made looking actually quite difficult. So volunteers were looking on foot and three-wheelers and on horseback.
So if she wandered away on foot at that point, do you think it's highly likely they would have found her?
You know, I actually was thinking this because, like, my backyard used to be, like, we bought this, like, fixer-upper house, right? And our backyard used to have, like, really tall grass in it. And I was actually thinking last night, like, if someone had, like, was in distress or deceased in my backyard at that time, I don't think I would have actually known because it was actually very difficult to see. And I think we make some assumptions that, like, that because they're searching an area that they're going to successfully find someone. And it's actually, you know, more difficult than I think people realize.
Okay.
As part of the search, the Department of Public Safety, they brought in helicopters and law enforcement had dogs searching the area as well. And now apparently there was some concern that she could have fallen into the Little River, which was reportedly experiencing flooding at the time. Now, navigating an unfamiliar area via Google Maps is a lot different than navigating a space on the ground. So if you're a listener from this area and can set me straight, I'd welcome it. But this does strike me as odd because it seems geographically in the opposite direction of where she was living and had been last seen. But reports do say they searched other area creeks, so maybe it just means they were looking everywhere in the Cameron area for her. Sheriff Charlie West, who had been a deputy at the time of her disappearance, said when she took missing, it showed how much everyone loved and respected her because of this massive search for her. Now, this search goes on for days without any sign of her. Eventually, as we've seen in other cases, some friends and relatives gather together to hire some psychics to locate her. Of this, Sheriff West said, "I remember a couple of people talking to me and gave me some information, but nothing we could use. You're going to find her near water. You're going to find her under some leaves." It's kind of how he characterizes it.
That's very general, too, because, like, this whole area sounds like there's leaves and water.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why, like, it didn't really help.
No.
move that case forward. Now, over the years, they have followed up on leads, like she was seen at a truck stop north of Temple, Texas, but nothing ever came of those. And it's hard to say, you know, that this is the extent of the information about her disappearance that's available publicly, but that kind of sums it up.
So that's all that ever came of it.
Yeah.
And did anyone, like, would there have been a motive for somebody to have taken her?
Well, you know, that's actually, you know, what I want to get into next. Okay. Like, why people kind of lean in one direction or another.
Right. Because I have, like, some ideas on the way that they were leaning mm-hmm. based on what you told me. But I'm wondering if also, like, if there was, like, a reason at any point for them to think that, oh, somebody definitely took her. So
right.
So I guess we'll get into that.
Yeah. So we've talked about before when someone goes missing, we expect certain things to happen. And in terms of the investigation and widespread media coverage, and particularly if you're in a small town in America, like where there's not necessarily a lot going on, you would think that a missing person would be like front page news and there'd be like nonstop coverage. But that's not often the case.
Which is like, I think one of the most difficult realizations I've had with us starting this project, like since we've started, is that not everybody gets the same coverage, but also that not everybody gets any coverage at all.
Right.
You know, like so it's just, it sounds like in this case, they do love her and they are looking for her, but the media, it's like the people that are looking for her seem to be the people who knew her directly, not so much the media, right?
Right. Well, so we don't have access to the television news that covered this area. So maybe the television news that covers Cameron, Texas was publicizing it at the time. Perhaps that was a more robust thing. Also, the Cameron, Texas newspaper is not fully digitized.
Okay.
So maybe, you know, the actual newspaper that covered Cameron was a little bit more, but it wasn't robustly covered in like regional newspapers.
Okay.
So
if it was, it would have been local.
Yeah.
Again, just like
hyper local.
Super. Okay.
Now, one of the things that I did encounter while doing some research on her story is that there has been some chatter on social media and on message boards about her. Now, we don't use claims from social media in our stories because anyone can post anything on mm-hmm. there. But what I do use those message boards is looking at kind of the broader picture of what's happening in those posts, like not about like what people's theories are, but about why those theories are circulating, if that makes sense.
Are you like looking for like other people's observations maybe and seeing if like maybe not their theories, but like their observations a little bit more?
So not really.
Okay.
Because again, I think one thing that happens in the true crime community particularly is like kind of people get their pet theories and aren't always able to see more broadly, right? But I do look at them to get a sense of, in a more like theoretical perspective, like what is happening and why is that happening?
Okay.
We'll be back in a moment.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, Terror Takes Center Stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
Whew. I'm an American vigilante. I have a question for you. What would you do if someone you cared about was abducted, taken from you? Would you call me? Would you care about how I got them back? Download American Vigilante now.
Now, for Bessie, these posts really fall into two categories. The first are posts from people who claim to remember her directly or remember the search for her. And what is apparent in these posts is the general regard people have for her. I think because she lived her last few years alone without her siblings and because she wasn't married, she was given that label loner in her missing persons report. And I think loner is construed as someone who either shuns or has been shunned by the community. And that's not the sense that I get here. She did, yes, live alone, but she was part of a community. And these social posts indicate this, and that's substantiated by what the sheriff was saying about the search for her.
Okay, so she's not a loner. She's just the last one of her family.
Right, and she was living alone.
Alone, but she sounds very social, very loved, very connected to her community.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Like, people recognized her. People had interactions with her or hired her for various
right.
tasks.
You don't necessarily need children or a husband to not be alone.
Right.
Yeah.
The second category of posts that I'm seeing about her are in regards to what actually happened to Bessie. And many of these posts engage with the idea that she could have been murdered. Mm-hmm. Now, when we do stories like this, I'm always cognizant of the fact that I'm an outsider to these communities, right? And I don't get to know the nuances or the histories of why these theories are present. So to put it more bluntly, like, this, we're not an investigative podcast where we figure out if Bessie was murdered or not. But I do find it intriguing, and not in a was Bessie murdered kind of way, but more in a why are we falling into that kind of suggestion? And not just about her specifically. So again, I'm not part of this community, so I'm not privy to a lot of those behind closed doors conversations. But on the surface here, we have a woman searching for cattle in the heat, in rigorous terrain, who seemed to be disorientated. And although she was only 63, her immediate family members died between the ages of 49 and 71, which means a life-ending medical event doesn't really seem too out of bounds in a situation like this.
Right. And as we mentioned, some of her family members died quite suddenly of just kind of like events within their own body.
Yes.
So that's not unheard of here. And if she's already overheated and overworked and disoriented, then anything could really happen.
Right.
Okay.
Which brings me to some broader points that I want to make about questions about the narratives that we tell about missing people. Like, what's the storytelling that happens about missing persons? Because that's what we do here, is we are telling these stories, yes. Right? The first is that we often broadly categorize types of missing persons, and these fall generally into two categories. So you're going to have to stick with me through this.
Okay.
Okay. The first category is forced disappearance. And forced disappearances, the child or adult is missing through forced abduction or through a violent crime. So we just did the story of Karma Purpura last week. She's an example of being a missing person through a violent crime. Though her alleged killer hasn't been convicted of her murder, we do know she encountered violence inside his truck cab due to the amount of blood inside. And forced abduction, that would be like our episode on Mary Shotwell Little, who was seen along with her potential abductor many, many miles away from her home.
We've actually covered a lot of both kinds of these cases.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they are definitely forced and usually very violent.
Yes. So cases like this, there's an immediate and compelling story, mm-hmm. right? Like, the missing person has been harmed or taken by someone else, and so we get to ask the questions, who harmed them or abducted them, and why, and will they be found, and will justice be served, right?
Okay, so I think I kind of know where you're going here. Like, those become the more interesting cases?
They become the cases that we tell and retell about missing persons, right? Okay. So we expect certain things from those stories, right? There's like, we get to connect the dots, right? And there's a level of satisfaction with the story. Mm-hmm. Like, even if it's unsolved, there's a belief at some point it will be resolved.
Right. There's like, it's like got this air of mystery. A lot of those ones are also with younger people. And you can almost like see some of those stories get almost like romanticized in a way. Like where we are dwelling on like how beautiful or how young or.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like so all of these things.
Points, right?
So sometimes lead to, I guess, probably more media coverage or more telling of the story.
Right.
Unlike the one we're talking about.
So the other broad category, though, is intentional disappearance. An intentional disappearance is the person is missing because they have voluntarily left. This could be, say, in cases of runaways or in cases where someone has just decided to go no contact with their family and friends. Now, interestingly, we, the general public, media, law enforcement are less likely to pay attention to those cases. We actually haven't covered a case that I could say definitively was a purely intentional disappearance. The nearest I would say was merely maybe Papau's story because she didn't leave behind clear evidence that she was intentionally separating from them. It's still kind of up in the air, right?
Right. And I think we've talked about this before where even a lot of the younger girls that we talk about kind of get dubbed runaways even if they're not.
Right.
And it really does lead to people looking for them a lot less.
Yes.
And that always makes me so angry because let's find our runaways.
Right.
Whether like, they're running away intentionally or not, let's find them. They're usually children.
Yeah. And so what I've been actually seeing recently is some interesting conversations about intentional disappearance that they aren't actually a thing.
What?
Yeah. Like that they're impossible, like contemporarily at least, because it would take a lot of knowledge to go missing without being traced digitally or physically. And that's simply not true, right?
No, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah. So the reality is that actually most missing persons cases are intentional. They are often resolved, though, much more quickly because someone comes home, resumes contact, or law enforcement is able to touch base with them. So that actually is more common to have intentional disappearance.
Right. Well, I think somebody could successfully complete an intentional disappearance if they really were motivated to do so.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. There are so many different ways that that could happen.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, it's fascinating. And I think it's, you know, that assumption comes because maybe we're not covering those stories enough, right? And when we do hear these stories, they are going to be different than the forced disappearance one. And that's because we're looking for, like, why are they leaving? Did they experience challenges or abuse or neglect? Like, what's going on there? And two, it's also one of the conversations that you and I have had quite a bit is that we're also well aware that someone can start off as intentionally missing and then encounter violence mm-hmm. during their time away. An example of this one would be the young teens that we covered in our story on the Green River killings. Like, they intentionally left their family and encountered violence.
Which is exactly why I'm saying that runaways are at more risk than anyone else, because there is nobody there to...
There's, like, not a safety net,
support right? them, right? Yeah.
And so, obviously, it's, like, concerning when someone is intentionally missing, but does their story, does their our desire to share it only become more pronounced if we do imagine that they have been, like, slipping into that missing by force category, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what these like broad categorizations don't leave room for are a wide swath of other disappearances. Like there's not just like a dividing line between these two categories and everything kind of neatly fits into one or the other. For instance, where would medical events fit? So if someone's experiencing a health-related issue and wanders off, for instance, or someone is in an accident and doesn't have ID on them, how do we process those stories and how do we relate to them?
Right, and that could be very well what happened in this case with Bessie. But I think, like you said earlier, like people will be quick to like think that it was falling into that force category. Like right away, that's where, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, well, there could be the part where she just wandered off because she wasn't feeling so good and something happened. But then somebody might also go with the other idea of like she was picked up for some reason or murdered for some reason. So, and I don't know, like I guess obviously there would be a lot more coverage if she actually was kidnapped or murdered.
Right. And so, you know, are we often moving to, as the general public, as people who are outsiders to these stories, you know, are we reclassifying them as forced incidences because that makes a more compelling story, right?
Definitely. And I do think, like I was saying before, I do think there are huge differences in how much we talk about a story based on the person's age or what that person looked like, or like we've talked about it before with like race or socioeconomic backgrounds. And in this case, I think an older woman wandering off and having a medical event and dying and disappearing is not as compelling of a story, is not as interesting as of a story. So yeah, those narratives might be made up in that case to try to like almost have like a different idea of what happened.
Right. And so my argument is that when we do that, we also do a disservice to the person who is missing. Mm-hmm. So when someone's like missing due to a health crisis, or maybe missing due to death by misadventure.
Do you want to clarify death by misadventure just for any of our listeners who don't?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it's not always like a commonly used phrase, but like death by misadventure is essentially a death that is accidental, usually through a person voluntarily engaging in kind of a risky behavior. So I'll use this one as an example because there's been a few deaths this way recently, which is that for whatever reason, someone goes and looks into a donation bin or a trash bin and then gets stuck inside, right?
Does that happen often?
Like, don't crawl into donation bins or trash bins.
Oh, really?
No.
Okay, I know people who do.
For like dumpster diving?
Yeah. Is that safe?
Well, like, you know, you really need to ensure that, like, there's no lid that can become accidentally closed. Like,
so it's like a buddy system thing?
Yeah. Like, someone should be...
Bring a buddy if you're going to dumpster dive?
Right. Like, yeah. And so people, like, often will get, like, stuck in donation bins. Yeah.
So from the photographer standpoint, I always kind of, like, the death by misadventure has a lot to do with people trying to get, like, photos or selfies in really risky locations.
Yes.
And that happens so often.
Yes.
It's just, yes. So right away when I hear that, that's exactly where I go. It's like, oh, somebody was trying to get a selfie.
Right. Right. So we've seen that.
Yes.
That happen, you know, much more frequently as we're able to take selfies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I want to go back to Bessie for a bit. Now, again, there are some rumors that her disappearance was forced in some manner, but I'm referring to this quote by the sheriff who said, "We just don't know what happened to her. We never did find any evidence of foul play. It appears the lady became disorientated, walked off, and something happened to her. I knew the lady. Everybody in town knew the lady." So what if we do rule out forceful disappearance in her case? And there doesn't seem to be any indication of a voluntary disappearance either. That does leave us in more of a gray area. And when it comes to true crime storytelling, stories like hers will get overlooked because they're not sensational. And it's likely there's no one to blame or cite as a perpetrator.
So it really is like a true crime story that falls out of the true crime boundaries.
Exactly, right.
So there's still an investigation. There's still a missing person, but there might not have ever been a crime.
Like a,
an actual violent crime.
And so one of the things that we say, you and I, about our podcast is that we're a victim-centered podcast. Mm-hmm. And even in saying that, there is some erasure that happens for stories like this that don't fit that label, right? She's not a victim of a perpetrator.
But she is definitely a victim of something.
Of something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that I haven't mentioned is that Bessie's file does say that she was experiencing dementia, although there does seem to be some pushback on that labeling, that, you know, simply saying that she was confused on the day she went missing, but this wasn't necessarily the norm for her.
Right. So I don't think it's fair to say that she has dementia unless she was actually diagnosed by a doctor for that, because I mean, honestly, anyone of any age can get confused if it's hot enough and you're tired enough.
Yes. But let's say, for argument's sake, that she was actually experiencing dementia.
Definitely, right? Possible.
And, you know, not as a condition of that moment, but like this is a longer situation. If our impulse is to always categorize missing persons stories as missing by force, we are going to lose critical conversations about what to do when someone with dementia or Alzheimer's goes missing.
Right.
So, for instance, are there certain preventative measures that we can take if someone is wandering risk? Or are the procedures that law enforcement should follow? Should community searchers be armed with different information if this is, like, common, right?
It is common, and I think there are definitely measures. It's just opening up that conversation.
Right. So I do want to have like a little bit of conversation about that, because I was like, well, okay, so what if she did have dementia? You know, what were the risks and what should have happened in the search for her, right? So there's this Canadian study, and again, we're not having enough conversations about this to be as broadly studied as it needs to be. Mm-hmm. So this Canadian study was done that was talking about how dementia rates are on the rise, and those rates are actually increasing at a significant pace. Their estimates are that at, you know, some point, 40% of patients with dementia will become lost at some point, and that the common search strategies used for residents without dementia aren't always in alignment with what should happen to missing residents with dementia. And one of these is that there should be no downtime between noticing the person is missing and calling police, because it's unlikely that they're going to self-return.
Right.
Right. They're not just going to be able to find their way back.
No. The higher chances that the stress is going to lead them to get more and more confused.
Right. And so there's this phrase, which is they'll often go until they're stuck, which means they'll just kind of wander forward until they come to a place like rougher terrain or an area that they cannot like continue to wander forward.
I hate that thinking.
Go until they're stuck.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. So like, yeah. You know, they said it's actually much more likely to encounter a person who's missing with dementia by, like, for instance, bodies of water, because like they will keep walking until they're like, and I can walk no more.
Right.
And whereas health conditions are often left off of missing persons reports, this would be a case where family members should be encouraged to include it, because it helps law enforcement publicize the risk for the missing person. And really, these approaches are important for people to know, so that when we try to reframe these stories or refit these stories into forced disappearances, it means we lose moments where we can make meaningful change to reduce those numbers, right? If we don't have conversations about how often this might happen, we're losing time to actually explore that and publicize
and
what
to
do.
And get the person home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, as for Bessie, the question will always be whether or not she'll be found. And I usually try to end our episodes with a quote from a loved one, but as Bessie was the last member of her immediate family, we don't have a quote from her immediate family member. And so that leaves me with some of the things that Sheriff West was saying in 2004. So now that's 20 years ago, and that's 12 years after Bessie went missing. On the one hand, he told reporters, "And I believe one of these days we're going to find her. I do not know if we're going to have to scientifically identify her, but I just feel in my heart and mind that one day we will find her." But he also said, "I don't know if we're ever going to know what happened to her." So for what it is worth, I hope that one day she'll be found and her remains can be buried alongside her siblings.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Backland, read by Catherine Mary Stewart. Catherine Mary Stewart is a veteran of over 30 years as an actor. Her film credits include Weekend at Bernie's, The Last Starfighter, Night of the Comet, and Mischief. She also played Kayla Brady on the soap opera Days of Our Lives and is known for her small screen roles in Hollywood Wives, Sins, and The Sea Wolf. Most recently, Catherine has appeared on popular series including New Amsterdam, Limitless, and White Collar, plus starring roles in many Hallmark, Lifetime, and independent movies. Not only does Catherine continue to work in front of the camera, but she also writes, produces, and directs. She is presently developing projects for the big screen, television, and the theater. Backland, about Bessie Ann Kutnick, 63, missing since August 16, 1992, from Cameron, Texas.
The grazier tamps down grass. Work boots rub against verdigris skin. Behind her, the murk of the farmhouse, still with rain, huddled along the hill crest. Ahead, the horizon, an opaline emulsion of air and ground, the coming night. She barely notes the spice in the air, or planetary revolutions of aphids in the sharp grass. They rotate around foxtails, bent on the collision of selves, the tangling of bodies. She wades forward, listens for lulling bellows, the stagger of hooves. She thinks she sees a dart black against the ground. Closer, against her eye, a sliver of shadow. Dark. until her fingers feel like the cavern of ice.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Ohio is a land of mystery. From missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.